Good afternoon. Thank you again for being here. I think you'll see a lot of overlap and a lot of commonality in some of the things that they just talked about, which is because we use the same database and we all work together. And I wanted to acknowledge the contributions of my colleagues, including Andrew Houghtonville, Kim Phillips, Michelle Stransky, who's also here, and Monica McLean, who's also here, and Charles Drum. Same research, same awesome funding from NIDR. Happy to have that grant funding this work, and we have no disclosures to report. So we know experience, and I want to say, so in some ways, this conversation should have preceded the other one because it and this kind of gives away the punchline to say that we needed to know statistically whether or not we should be subdividing these groups. As you saw, we did. So that's the punchline. But we know experientially and conceptually that the population of people with disabilities is not a homogeneous group. And instead, there are important differences that vary by disability type. And these can include healthcare needs, communication styles, preferred learning styles, and levels of need for support. And in many ways, not just in this conversation, but in other conversations you probably heard this week, we've already organized public health policy and practice in that way around different subgroups of disability. But while we know through experience that these differences exist in subgroups, there hasn't been a study that we know of that has examined whether there is statistical justification for that, not just experiential justification, to support the need for conducting our research in this way, where we subdivide the bigger population of people with disability into subgroups by disability type. Thus, our study objective was to determine whether future public health research about people with disabilities will likely have the greatest impact if we target it to subgroups of people with disabilities or to an aggregated cross-disability group. Again, you'll see a lot of commonality. Our methods involved pooling 7 years of medical expenditures panel, or MEPS, survey data from 2004 to 2010. And this provides us with a nationally representative sample of community-dwelling people. This says community-dwelling adults because we focused our work on the working age, 18 to 64. And this resulted in an unweighted N of 131,000 and a weighted N of 1.3 billion. We, as Charles mentioned, we subdivided this group into one of six mutually exclusive groups, and that's an important distinction to make. He named the six: cognitive limitations, physical limitations, hearing impairments, visual impairments, multiple limitations, and no limitations. And so if a person was in the cognitive limitations group, that meant they reported no other disability, for example. But if they were in the multiple limitations group, they could have any two or more of cognitive, physical, hearing, or visual impairments. And we conducted logistic regression and Wald test for our analyses. So we conducted omnibus tests as well as pairwise tests. And it's really hard to articulate these kind of tests in a few words, but for ease in explaining what we did and how they differ statistically, I'll describe the pairwise comparisons first because it's easier to understand that kind of intuitively. So pairwise comparisons compare each of the disability groups, to the other groups individually in pairs. And this is to determine whether any two of the groups should be combined or modeled together or separately. And so this slide is to show examples of how those pairwise comparisons, but it was for every single possible pairwise comparison. And statistically, this is done by comparing the slopes of the line for each of the groups to see whether they differ in a fully interactive model. The omnibus test is similar. It involves comparing the line for the all disabilities groups, so the big group, not subdivided, to the values for the lines of the individual groups of disabilities, and seeing if they differ. Or as my colleague told me this today, it's kind of like pairwise comparisons on steroids. I like that. It makes my brain happy to think about it that way. So for the results of, so now I'm backing up and going, well, we did the omnibus comparison first, because if there was no reason, if there was no difference between the all disability group and the subgroups, then there was no reason to subdivide it at all. So the finding from that is that, I didn't talk about the outcomes, did I? Got my slides out of order, sorry about that. Let me back up and talk about those really quickly. So we have 10 outcomes of interest. Charles talked about several, and Kim, pap test, mammogram, dental, and flu shot. But we also looked at usual source of care, delayed or not received necessary care, self-reported physical health, health insurance status, self-reported mental health, and multiple chronic conditions. And we chose these, one, because they're available in the METS, and two, because we wanted to follow up, as Charles and Kim talked about, to go in depth, more in depth, and drill down about that information a little more in more detail. So back to the results of the omnibus test. All of the tests were significant at the 0.01 level for the omnibus test. And this suggests that the disability subgroups should be modeled separately, not as one big group. And the results of the pairwise comparisons were very similar. They weren't as strongly statistically significant, but the results of these tests also suggest that it's not best to estimate any of the pairs together in a single regression for any outcome. So we should not look at, that means we should not combine any two of the groups together to look at these outcomes. We should look at all five of the different types of groups individually. These results confirm what we know experientially and conceptually, as I started with, that the disability subgroups have sufficiently unique attributes to statistically justify analyzing them separately as five individual groups. But it's important to talk about the implications of these findings. And in thinking about those implications, it's really critical to consider research separate from policy and practice. And I think this also, it highlights and emphasizes the importance of knowledge translation, or translating our research into practice. And so continuing to understand how our evidence informs our policy and practice. And as this study showed, we need to conduct our research in ways that account for disability type. And this confirms what we already knew in terms of experiential evidence. But this doesn't mean that we should organize our public health programs and our policies in this way overall. And this is for two main reasons. First is that programs targeting specific disability groups can be costly and difficult to sustain. And second, we have an obligation to include people with disabilities to the greatest extent possible in the mainstream public health activities. And creating silos contradicts this obligation. Therefore, we recommend that we continue to conduct research about subgroups that provides a good understanding of the unique characteristics affecting health and health promotion, but that we use this evidence to effectively and appropriately tailor the guidelines that inform mainstream health promotion programs through a cross-disability universal approach wherever possible. So in conclusion, we have the statistical evidence to back up our experiential evidence that we should examine the subpopulations of people with disabilities separately, and that wherever possible, our public health programs should use this evidence on these individual groups in a way that incorporates that information but adapts existing programs for the mainstream population to make sure that we've addressed everybody's needs in not just in isolation. Thank you.